Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Let's please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Danette.
Hi, everybody. My name is Danette. I'm an alcoholic. And you probably don't need a microphone too much to hear me. Tend to have some good vocal cords. I was thinking about speaking here this evening and just asking my higher power to let me bring the message that he would have me share. I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that, really it's one alcoholic identifying with the other that gives the strength to this program. I believe it was read earlier this evening. And so what I really have to share is my story. And through the course of that, life happens. Life happens. I started drinking at a late age compared to many of us. I was 17 and I'd gone to live with my grandparents up in Paradise, up by Chico. And I had an aunt there that was, she was like 22. And she turned me on to alcohol. And I thought it was just the nastiest tasting stuff I'd ever run into. I can't imagine why they didn't give me some Kool-Aid sort of Boone's Farm type of drink, but that's not what happened. And I caught a buzz. And, right away, alcohol had this effect on me. The first time I drank, I didn't like it. And that changed from the second time on. And what happened is I was living there with my grandparents. My family was back in Colorado. And I had ended up in juvenile hall in San Jose. And my grandparents had come and picked me up and I was staying with them. And I made a couple friends there in high school, and we got this 2 bottles of Boone's Farm and shared it among 4 people. And I had that first experience of magic that alcohol does for those of us that are allergic to it. And it just made me feel like life was so okay. All of that separation from my family in Colorado and the fact I'm living with my grandparents and things are chaotic, it just doesn't matter. And I feel powerful and complete and whole and competent and able and all of the stuff I always wanted to feel like that's who I was. And alcohol brought that to me in such a powerful way. It was magic, absolute, perfect feeling of well-being. And a few days later when, the boyfriend I was interested in hadn't called me and life seemed kind of dark, and I knew if I could get something to drink, I would be okay. I think from the beginning, I was an alcoholic. I made that connection that alcohol does something for me that I need done. And I drank for the effect that alcohol produced when I consumed it. I did find my way down to the friend's brother's house and got myself a couple somethings. And I remember walking back to my grandparents' house, it's like, a quarter mile. And I'm looking up at the stars and I'm thinking how I'm part of the universe and how I belong, and who cares about that guy? My life is going to unfold in this perfect way. And alcohol gave me that sense of well-being right from the beginning. I didn't get to drink all the time. I was 17 when I had that first drink, and I moved back to Colorado. But I drank every chance I got. And when I didn't feel good inside, it became imperative to find something that would change the way I felt. I would go to great lengths and put myself in danger to you know, again, it was a friend's brother's house that lived, you know, 20 miles away. And you know, I'd hitchhike over there. And then my good thinking and the reasonable choices I make for myself when I drink, those go away, you know. And I'm driven by this knee-jerk thing. And at 4 o'clock that morning, I decide where I really need to be is home. And so at 4 o'clock that morning, I'm out there trying to hitchhike back, you know, to where I think I need to be. Alcohol, you know, it kind of came and went, and I drank as often as I could, but that wasn't all the time. In 79, I moved to California, and I must say one of the reasons I didn't drink all the time was that in Colorado, you have to buy alcohol in liquor stores. You can't just go into the grocery store and pick up what you want. So it was a little more difficult to obtain alcohol. When I got to California, that went away. And I was living in the San Diego area, and you know, they had just come out with boxes of wine, and I like to drink wine because I discovered that hard liquor made me really mean. I'd want to fight, and I don't want to be a fighter, you know, I just want to have a good time. And so I mostly stuck to wine and beer at that point of my drinking. And I had a lot of fun and a lot of good times. You know, alcohol freed me up to be in the moment. You know, I get kind of nervous and uncomfortable, and I get a few drinks, and I'm just ready to experience whatever's happening, go where the crowd's going, and have a good time. And I like that about myself. That's who I want to be. When I lived in San Diego, I had a little motorcycle, and I used to throw my roller skates across the back of it and put on my little hot bikini in this, you know, 20-year-old body and drive down to Mission Beach and go roller skating on the boardwalk and meet friends and influence people, you know. I've just always loved to have fun. I mean, who doesn't, you know? And that's where alcohol took me, and that's where I wanted to go. And then some of the consequences of drinking started happening, you know. And I did, many of us call it a geographic, you know. I wasn't finding my way there in San Diego, so I moved to L.A. And then I moved from L.A. up to Sonoma, and then I moved back to L.A. And, you know, trying to find where I fit, trying to find that sense of well-being that it appears to me everybody else just has naturally. And I'm comparing my insides to their outsides, and I'm looking around and saying, if only I had this, if only I had that, my life would be good. And I was sure that one of the main things that was missing from my life was someone that would love me properly. If I could just find the right him, I wouldn't drink the way I did, because that emptiness I felt inside, that sense of not belonging and fitting in and that need to be more than I was, you know, all of that was going to be satisfied when he arrived, you know. I don't know, some kind of knight on the white horse image. And when I moved up to Visalia area, I had been working for a company down in Southern California. I got a good job, and you know what? I always had to have a job. Having a job meant I was okay. It meant I could support myself. It meant I wasn't hoping that someone would take care of me, because you know, God knew when he was going to show up, whoever this knight on the white horse was going to be. And so I moved up to Visalia after getting this good job, and I transferred up and ended up in Visalia. And you know, my drinking was crazy. I drank on the job. I drank to get a job. I drank to cope with not having a job. I drank to enjoy my vacation. I drank when I was melancholy. I drank when I was disappointed. Alcohol started becoming a solution to everything. And I lost jobs behind drinking, you know, and I would go get another one because I'm reasonably intelligent and can usually manage. You know, I supported myself through high school. I knew that I had to have a job. And so I took all these business classes, you know. So I had a set of skills that would let me in some job somewhere. I'm feeling nervous. So I got that job, and I moved up to from LA to Bakersfield, and then from Bakersfield up to Visalia. And I tried to show up for work as much as I could, you know. I mean, and I felt they were kind of lucky when I made it in, you know. And I can remember sitting there, and we're all in our little cubicles, you know, in the clerical department there, and I'm kind of rocking back and forth in my chair and humming to myself a little bit because I feel I need comforting, you know. I'm like just so empty inside, and I'm one of those alcoholics that stays up till 2, 3, 4 in the morning and then tries to get into work at 7. And it's a tough go, you know. So I'm working for that job and I'm getting in all kinds of trouble. I'm getting called on the carpet. My boss is documenting all of my mistakes. I got demoted. I got in her office one more time, and you know, I'm going through all of this and I'm getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. The consequences are getting greater. That peace, that sense that alcohol used to just like provide to me with a few drinks is gone, and I am just trying to look like I'm doing okay. It's the best I can do where I end up, you know. And I'm showing up for that job during the day, and I'm running around with a bunch of hoodlums at night and trying to be okay, you know, trying to hold it together. And what happened was my boss called me into that office one more time and she said, you know, I'd like to help you. I don't know what the problem is. Yesterday you sent 7 accounts out to be closed and people had paid their bills. You're making us look bad again. And, you know, it's just kind of like backed in the corner, right? All this stuff going on, and I'm not a quitter, I'm a fighter. I've been hanging on to this with everything I can and looking like I'm doing okay to the best I can. And at that moment, I told her, I said, you know, sometimes I drink too much. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. But she got on the phone and found out what my insurance would cover. And they sent me to a 30-day program that I stayed at for 60 days. And I hated it. I hated it. You know, it was taking away everything I knew to do to make myself feel good. It was taking away my rights. It was taking away, you know, my choices, because now I'm living in this group home environment and people are telling me what to do and nobody tells me what to do. I'm just fierce about it, right? That's why I'm hanging on to the job. I take care of myself. And I remember going to one of those meetings and you know, and I didn't want to go. I was having a really bad day, and I told those people at the recovery home, I can't go. You can see I'm a mess. And they just kept saying, you're going. And I go, I'm going to make you look bad. You know, that they would have someone so messed up in their recovery home. It's all. So, you know what happened? And we talk about it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I had a spiritual awakening. Some people have big ones. Mine was little itty bitty. And, you know, really, what I realized is I wanted more for my life. I wanted more than pretending. I wanted more than staying up till all hours of the morning and then trying to look like I was doing okay. I wanted more. And I heard people in these rooms laughing and having a good time and saying they thought it was possible to live well and not drink. And I didn't think so, but I could see they thought so. And some of them were saying they'd stayed sober for like unbelievable, 3 months. Who stays sober for 3 months? Yeah, I went 2 days once. I thought that was like I'd overreacted. and promptly went back to drinking because that's what I really, that's what made me feel good. Why would I deny myself that? So I stayed in that home largely to keep my job, get the people off my back that were bothering me. But that spiritual awakening, that realizing I wanted more for my life, just put this little crack in my wall, in my armor, in my unwillingness to consider someone else's way. And I became just a tiny bit willing. And it didn't mushroom or bloom from there. You know, what happened was that I continued on for a number of years on just self-will. I won't drink, and I will figure out what it is I need to do to fix myself. And I got a sponsor and kind of sort of did some stuff, but, you know, I just didn't really fit in, and I had another sponsor who would just listen to me cry. And, you know, I'm glad that she was there for me because I had a lot of pain in my soul. But when things really changed for me was when I called up a woman that I'd met at a retreat, you know, and I'm going to 5 different 12-step programs. I'm trying to deal with my, with all my life through these, you know, so I'm running in circles. I'm going to Cocaine Anonymous and Codependence Anonymous and Debtors Anonymous, and I'm going to Adult Children of Alcoholics, and I'm going to AA, and I'm going to NA. Oh, wait, that's 6, you know, I'm like, you know, and I'm doing nothing in any of them but seeking out the fellowship and listening in meetings. And I got to a point where I wanted more for my life again, where I wanted more for my life. And I didn't quite know how this was going to happen, but I figured it was still the relationship that was going to come into my life and make everything bloom and be wonderful. And so I sought out someone in... 7. Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. All right? So I get a hold of this woman and I say, I need some help with my relationships. And she says, well, how long has it been since you haven't drank? And I'm like, it has been a lot of years. 5. I'm waiting for the applause. And she says, well, how's your AA program? I said, well, it's pretty good. Without it, you know, I'd be dead, I said, but, you know, I haven't drank. And she said, you know, I believe, she wanted to know if I'd done my steps. And she said, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. I said, you know, that's true. Alcoholics Anonymous is paramount. Without it, I just can't imagine where my life would be. But where I'm needing help is with my relationships. She wasn't hearing me, you know. And she said, you know, Jeanette, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. You know, and she said that the second time, and I heard it. And I heard it, and I knew that I had not used this program. I'd used the fellowship. I had used some of the service, which is part of our triangle, right? We've got the unity, the service, and the recovery. So I'd been a secretary, and I'd been, you know, kind of coming and going to meetings, and I became willing to do the steps. And what a transformation occurred as a result of that work. I hooked up with a sponsor who knew what the steps were, who knew how they had affected her life, and was able to direct me to the solution found therein. Up until this time, I'd been running around doing my best thinking, doing a lot of things I thought were going to make my life better, and not drinking, mind you. And I just was getting kind of crazy, you know, because I'm still looking for him to come in and fix it. I just know that that is, you know, and that's what worked for Snow White. That's what worked for Sleeping Beauty. So we opened that big book, and I became convinced through that work that I did with her, convinced my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And there was a lot of freedom in there. There was a sense I could not control this crazy disease, this crazy craving for alcohol. This, you know, people said you're bodily and mentally different from your fellows. Well, bodily different is when I take that drink. I crave another drink. It like wakes up something in me that is thirsty, very thirsty. And then I've got a head that says to me, drinking's the answer. Drinking's what's fixed you. Drinking has let you fit in. Drinking is good. You know, you have a lot of fun when you drink. And so I've got this head that tells me that's the solution again. And I'm not going to drink that much this time, and I'm not going to do what I did last time I drank. I'm going to manage what I do when I drink. And that's what I hoped to find when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, was a way to control what I did. I didn't want to stop drinking, but I wanted to stop paying the price. And what happened with that, as we worked through the steps, I began experiencing more and more freedoms. And she helped me see how this program applied to all areas of my life. And how being powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable also applied to me being powerless over other people, because I was trying to control and enjoy them too. And I began on a journey. I hadn't drank, but my life began to have more substance. I began to like be more comfortable with myself, see who I was. I became more honest. It wasn't easy. And I remember when I was in the recovery home, they used to take us to this women's meeting. And it was on a Tuesday night, and it was at some little church across from the ballpark, and they had little bitty chairs that these really, really old women would sit in. Women that are probably younger than me. But they seem really old when I was 27. And we were awful. You know, we'd come in from that recovery home and we'd pass notes and we'd laugh, and all we were interested in was getting the driver to stop at the mini mart so we could load up on some sweets and drinks and, you know, Cokes and stuff. And I started going back to that meeting, and I found there a home group. And that's been so important to me. I have a group that I go to every week. I take my feet there. My head doesn't always want to go. You know, my head says there's something more interesting. My head says you need to relax and be good to yourself and stay home. But if I take my feet, I'm always glad I've gone. That group of women has changed. You know, some of the old timers passed away, and some moved away, and some I don't know. You know, we sometimes change meetings or whatever. But so I started going there, and I started working the steps with this sponsor, and did a thorough fourth step. And I was scared to death of doing this, because after 5 years of not drinking, I still hadn't addressed those character patterns in me that seemed to take, that I needed the relief from, right? And I was very relieved to hear that it's a moral inventory, not an immoral inventory. And it was suggested that I take it like a business takes an inventory. What's working in my life and what is not? And if I can take a look at that, maybe I can get rid of some of the things that aren't working. But I never sat down and looked at what was really going on. I was too busy, you know? So this process of going through the steps was phenomenal. And that sponsor worked with me for a number of years. And then she started suggesting that I get an in-town sponsor. I found a sponsor that was some distance away. There was a woman that had moved to town from Sierra Madre that had a light about her that I wanted. I wanted to know what she had. You know, what was she doing right? And she had written some time before she moved up here to central office and said, I'd like a contact up there so that I'm not moving to a new city cold. So if you find yourself moving, that may be a good piece of advice to follow, that when she got to Visalia, she knew someone. So this lady, Patty, and I are writing back and forth to each other and kind of sharing who we are and how we work our programs. And she was just terrific, you know, on paper. I mean, she's just an amazing woman. And so I can hardly wait. She's moving up to Visalia. I finally get to meet her. And I walk in the meeting, and she's gotten there early, and I'm looking. I'm like, oh, my God, that's Patty. And I fucking hate her, right? Because she's beautiful, and she's thin, and she's driving a really nice car, and she looks like she's got money. And all my insecurities just go, you know, I don't think I like her. And, you know, and it's so crazy that my eyes can tell me stuff like that, but I already love her. So what do you do with a thing like that, you know? So I got to know her, and as I saw that light in her that I wanted for myself, I asked her to be my sponsor. And, wow, what a difference one sponsor makes to another. I mean, it was all good. The first one took me through the book. We did a lot of work. I became convinced to my innermost self, as I shared, that I'm an alcoholic. And I got a huge bit of freedom from doing that work with my first sponsor. And then when Patty and I started working together, I thought she was doing it all wrong. You know, she was just very, very relaxed about it. She asked me questions like, well, what do you want to work on? I'm like, what? Well, yes, she said, you've been sober a number of years, you know. And so I begin a whole new journey through the steps again. And what I found is that as I get more clarity, as I'm able to be more truthful with myself and others, then I can see different depths and different layers. We talk about it here as like peeling an onion, you know. And those first fears and those first, you know, I like to call them, you know, we talk about that fourth step and doing the moral inventory. And they're really like all these character defects, many of them stem from defense mechanisms. And they're things that allowed me to survive and thrive and cope with my world as I was growing up with disappointments. And so there's not that same shame. It's not these horrible things that I've done. It's like defense mechanisms. And she shared that with me and a lot of other things. And I began a new period of growth in my sobriety. And I became very excited again about what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, about the strength of this program, about the freedoms that come as a result of doing the work in this program. And when we finished that set of steps, I had this whole new bit.
Dry spot. What do you do about that?
Damn, and I was doing so good.
So, where was I? Excuse me. So, my life changed again. When I began doing that work with Patty. And I loved her so much and what she brought to my life. she moved. And I've been taught. That was a bad one. And I believe that it's important for me to have a sponsor. Because what happens is I don't see my own stuff, you know. I think it's someone else's fault. I think that that I've been wronged and I was totally innocent in the happenings. So I got another sponsor. And then sometimes things, you know, don't work out. And I needed another sponsor. And that's okay, because every sponsor I've ever had has given me gifts. And I've continued to grow and learn from all of them. I think with Patty, the thing I got the most about was on step 6 and 7. Because all through that sobriety, there was still so much self-will. It was all about, I'm going to hang on, I'm going to make it happen, I'm going to make sure that I'm taken care of. I didn't have a lot of belief in a loving God that was going to open the doors that should open. Even though I'm like working towards a relationship with a higher power. And I have to tell you, briefly, I was terrified when I got here and people were talking about God. You know, I had this large part of my upbringing prior to about the age of 14, largely involved with church. And, you know, we went to church a lot, we prayed a lot. But things were still like crazy at home, you know. So I got here and I just knew. Boy, I wish I get my voice back. I think that's it. I just knew that you were going to start telling me who God was, how I had to believe in Him, what I had to do to be saved, and that unless I would line up and do all this stuff, I wasn't going to be allowed to continue in this program. And what I found was that we say God as you understand Him. And we don't tell you, this is what you must believe. We say find a higher power, someone that can, you know, take the burdens that you can't handle. So those steps 6 and 7 helped me a great deal to become right-sized. I was no longer running the show or trying to be the top dog. Well, no, I was, but I was learning that that wasn't good. I was learning in little ways to let that go, because that had been just a huge part of who I was, of how I moved through life. It served me well. And as I came through the steps again, I got new insights. I got new joy, new freedoms. And then we started on the traditions. And it was really cool. I mean, the traditions, and some of you may not be real familiar with them. We read them in the meetings. But the traditions were developed because alcoholics are kind of headstrong and opinionated. Surprise, right? So what happened was that groups started having rules. And if you read the Daily Reflections, yesterday's reading talks about it a little. How we had all these rules about who could be members and how they could fit and what could work, because we were afraid of losing our little lifeboat. You know, until Bob and Bill, the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, got together, alcoholics were pretty much doomed. Doomed. There was like, you know, Dr. Young said to Roland Hazard, as you read in the book, you'll find, you know, Dr. Young was one of the greatest psychologists of his time.
And he said, I really cannot help you with this thing. Alcoholism is not just in the mind. We are mentally and bodily different from our fellows. And so, you know, Roland said, is there no hope for someone like me? And he said, well, you can have the vital spiritual experience, VSE. And some people, through that process, have been able to quit drinking. So Roland came back to the States and began to seek that out in the Oxford group. And what experience showed alcoholics, through the experience of the Oxford group, which was a Christian-based organization, is that if we get diverted from our primary purpose, if we start trying to deal with the world's woes or make decisions about prohibition or anything else, we get too diverted and we lose the strength that our primary purpose affords us, which is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. So I kind of touched on having other sponsors. And, you know, I have a sponsor today because I can't see my own stuff. I continue to go to meetings because, one, I get to hear and be reminded what it was like for me when I drank. And I hope that I get to be useful, you know, whether it's something I say or just by showing up and being at a meeting to other people that want to have sobriety in their life. I was told I had to change everything when I got here. And I think if I'd been hanging out with those people that I used to party with, it would have been very difficult for me. I was so fragile. You know, I just wanted to feel good again. And what did I know about feeling good was an escape that alcohol provided quickly. What I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the steps, the solution offered here, the friendships that you'll find and make as you trudge the road of this happy destiny, replace for me, and there's a part in our book that says, have we a substitute? Yes, and it is vastly more than that. It's talking about a substitute for that escape, that mind-altering chemicals, alcohol, bring us. We have a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that it's important for me to not take mind-altering substances. When I was about 8 months down this journey of recovery, it became clear to me that I couldn't be doing drugs and saying I was sober. And I went to the meetings that I'd been celebrating this time at, and I let them know. I didn't want to have two sobriety dates. I didn't want to play the game. Oh yeah, I haven't drank. You know, it's just, if I'm going to get the blessings, the value, the freedoms of this program, it's very beneficial to me to be clear and honest. I just can't hide and pretend like I thought was working for me. So I want to thank everyone. I want to congratulate the chip takers. It's a gift to come and share my little piece of story with you. And the last thing I want to say is, you know, we talk about trudging that road of happy destiny. And many of us think of the word trudge as slogging away, you know, like through heavy mire. And the meaning of the word from the dictionary during the time period in which the big book was written means walking with purpose in a direction. So, yeah, there's some ending that should be like profound, but that's not to be mine tonight. So thank you for coming, and stay sober one more day, huh?